The Torah tells us that when Israel left Egypt, they ran out of food after 30 days. Our sages explain that the matzah that they had hurriedly baked on their way out of Egypt miraculously lasted for 30 days. From the 15th of Nisan, the day they left in the afternoon, it lasted for 61 meals until the 15th of the month of Iyar, which happened to be on a Saturday that year. They left Egypt on a Thursday. The 15th of the month of Iyar was on the 15th of Nisan. 15th of the month of Iyar, 30 days later, was a Saturday. So, having run out of food now, they had nothing to eat. They had eaten matzah, this little amount of matzah. Somehow, they only had a little bit and they were full. They didn't need to eat a lot. It lasted.
Did they survive on matzah?
They did. Survive on matzah.
30 days.
For 30 days, for 61 meals, they ate two meals a day. So they ate 61 meals with the matzah. It somehow, they extended and expanded, or they only ate a few crumbs and that was enough. And they were able to last, but now ran out. So having run out of food, they turn to Moshe and Aaron and they complain. Why did you take us out of Egypt to die of hunger? So Hashem turns to Moshe and tells him, do not worry. It will rain bread from heaven. And that way I will test the people to see if they will follow me or not. So the next morning, which was Sunday, the 16th of Iyar, there was a layer of dew on the ground around the camp, followed by a thin white thing that looked, or a thin open thing that looked like frost on the ground. The people didn't know what it was, and they called it man in Hebrew, or manna is the anglicized way to pronounce it. We'll talk soon exactly where that name came from. But first I want to tell you the story. So they asked Moses, what is this? Moses says, oh, that's the bread that Hashem has promised you. And he told them everyone should collect exactly one omer per person in their household. An omer is about 3.5 pounds, a little over 3.5 pounds. Everyone should collect one omer and take it home. 3.5 pounds is about the amount that an average person eats per day. So that every person would have to finish the entire omer of manna every single day. They would not be able to leave any of it over to the next day. So they all collected the manna. And when they collected the manna, they found that those that had collected more still ended up with one omer per person. When they measured it, they found that they had an omer per person in their household. Those that had collected much less also ended up with an omer of manna. So no matter how much they intended to collect or tried to collect, miraculously they ended up with exactly one omer of manna per person. You couldn't outsmart the manna. You couldn't get more and you couldn't get less. Yes, Lewis.
So a child's portion was the same as...
That's a very good point. Our sages point out that a child's portion would have been the same as an adult portion, and the children somehow also ate a manna. Ate an omer of manna, even though it would be a very large amount for a child. But it seems every person was exactly an omer. That's exactly how much they ate. They had to finish the whole thing. Some people, though, did not listen to Moses when he said that they're not allowed to leave over to the next day. And they left over manna to the next day, and it became full of worms, and it smelled and was unedible. So for the next 6 days, starting on the 16th of Iyar, they collected manna each and every day, starting on Sunday the 16th of Iyar. On the sixth day, which was a Friday, the people were surprised to find that they ended up with two omers per person, double what they had collected previous days. They were very surprised. They came to Moshe. So what's going on? He told them, well, tomorrow is going to be Shabbos. And because it's going to be Shabbos, you won't have any manna. The extra manna that you got today, the double portion, was for today and for Shabbos. What you should do is cook and bake everything that you need to prepare today so that you can rest tomorrow on Shabbos. And from now on, every Friday, you will get a double portion of manna, and you will not get any manna on Shabbos. On Friday, you will prepare all your needs for Shabbos. And this was the very first Shabbos that the people kept. In fact, I said that the manna first landed on Sunday, and then 7 days later, 6 days later was Friday. They got double, and the seventh day was Shabbos. The truth is that there was no Sunday when the manna first landed. There was no week. The very first week ever observed was that week when the manna fell. Day six of the manna, Moshe said, this is the sixth day of the week. Shabbos, there won't be any manna. Day six, you get double. The day seven is going to be Shabbos. The next day, you'll start the cycle again. That was how they started counting weeks. That was, in fact, the first Shabbos. Now, although Hashem had given them the manna to test them, they failed again. And some people went out the next day on Shabbos to see if they could find manna, and they were not able to find any. So Hashem had mentioned to Moshe that he was giving them the manna to test them, to see if they would listen, and they failed both in their rule that they're not allowed to leave any over to the next day, as well as the rule that they cannot collect on Shabbos. There will not be any manna. So they continue throughout their time in the desert, although the Torah doesn't mention it regularly, but throughout their time in the desert, as they reach Mount Sinai, and as they hear the Ten Commandments, and as they worship the golden calf, and they get the tablets and build the Mishkan, throughout this time there is manna falling. And then they leave Mount Sinai and they're traveling every day. There is manna in the morning when they wake up, there's manna on the ground, and they are collecting manna. Then, 1 year later, just over a year after they had left Egypt, just over a year after the manna began falling, the people turn to Moshe and start complaining about the manna. You mentioned it earlier. They turn to Moshe and they say, what are we eating? All we see every single day is manna. There's no variety. We're eating the same thing every single day. They're sick of it. We're eating the same thing. All our eyes only see manna, they say. They say, we remember back in Egypt, we used to eat fish and cucumbers and melons and leeks and onions and garlic. We ate all these things in Egypt, and now all we got is manna. And so they say, we want meat. Give us meat. Give us something. Excuse me. Give us something other than manna. So Moshe gets upset at them, and he turns to Hashem saying, how can we supply meat? Hashem says, don't worry, I'll give you a month worth of meat, more than they can imagine. And then Hashem had the wind blow quail that landed all around the camp. People gathered the quail, they slaughtered it, they ate it, but the people who ate the quail all ended up dying because they were not relying on the manna. So the people learned their lesson that they were to eat manna for 40 years. Yes?
I thought that manna would manifest itself, that it would taste like anything.
Yes.
That you wanted it to.
Yes, we're going to mention that. Yes, very good point.
And I have another question. What did the animals eat?
What did the people's animals eat?
Yes.
Presumably they ate manna too. In fact, the Midrash tells us that not only that, it says the leftovers, whatever they did not collect every morning, the sun would shine on it and it would melt. What happened? So the Midrash says it turned into streams and the animals would eat it. And then other people would slaughter these animals and they tasted very good because they had the money in them. So the people... excuse me. So the people continue to eat manna for the entire 40 years of their journey in the desert. According to our sages, the manna stopped falling after Moses died, which was just 33 days before they entered the land of Israel, which would have been Moses died on the 7th of Adar, according to our tradition, on the 40th year. So it would have been 40 years. The manna fell 40 years minus a little over 2 months that the manna fell each and every day. But that final collection of manna that they collected on the day that Moses died miraculously lasted them for another 40 days because they didn't cross into the promised land until 33 days later on the 10th of the month of Nisan. And even then, they waited until the 16th of Nisan when the Omer sacrifice was brought, because you're forbidden from eating fresh grain from the new produce until after the Omer sacrifice. So only on the 16th of Nisan, once they offered the Omer sacrifice from barley that they found in the land of Israel, then they went and they harvested the Canaanite grain, which God told them they could do, even though it belonged to the Canaanites. They were going to take over their land regardless. And they were able to eat the grain of the Canaanites, and at that point they stopped eating manna. So that's the story of the manna in short. Now, why was it called manna? Where did the name manna come from? So the Torah tells us that as soon as they saw, the first time they saw it, they said, manhu, it is manna, or it is man in Hebrew. What does man mean? What do they mean, it is man? So there's different opinions. Rashi, the classic commentary on the Torah, says man means prepared. Prepared food, ready to eat food. Or Rav Sadia Gaon, who lives in the 10th century, says it just means food. It means food itself, man. Others say that the word man is similar to the Hebrew word ma, which means what? They said, mahu, what is it? They didn't know what it was. They said, what is it? And so that's where the name man came from. Or Rabbeinu Hananel says that not what is it, but man is like me'ayin. From where? Where did this come from? So they were also asking a question, me'ayin hu, where does it come from? Where does this man, where does this thing come from? And therefore they called it man. Another explanation, Rabbeinu Bachaye, a 13th century Spanish scholar, says man means a gift, like mana is a portion or a gift in Hebrew. It means a gift because it was a gift from God. Regardless, it became known as man. Now, what exactly did the mana look like? What did it taste like? So the Torah describes the mana as being white, like frost, or elsewhere it says white like crystal. Some commentaries say maybe it should be clear like crystal, right? I guess crystal could be either white or clear. But it appears that it was white. The Torah definitely describes it as white. The Torah also says that it was small and round like a God seed. Kizra God, a God seed. What is a God seed? So most commentaries translate God as a coriander seed. Coriander is a very small bean or seed that is kind of looks like a little ball. It's a ball shape. So little round balls. So the Torah would have been, but corianders are not white. They're brown. But this was white, but looked the shape of the coriander seed. So what did the manna actually taste like? So in one place, the Torah says that it tasted like tzapichis bidvash, pancake in honey with honey. Or some translate it as a cracker with honey. Elsewhere, the Torah describes it as tasting like leshad hashamet, which is translated as a honey oil cake. Some say refined oil, fine oil. Or some even translate leshad from the word shadayim, which means breasts, breast milk. That it tasted like. So the Talmud explains the contradiction that for children, it tasted like honey, because that's what children like, sweets. For adults, it tasted like bread. It's also called bread in the Torah. And for seniors, it tasted like oil. They needed something very soft, so it was very soft. They had trouble chewing. So it tasted like oil. I guess the texture. Others suggest that the taste varied on how it was prepared and how it was served, or it varied per person. But the Talmud and the Midrashim, and someone mentioned this a moment ago, say that it actually tasted like anything that you wanted. It could taste like anything that you wanted it to taste like. And the tastes that are mentioned in the Torah are only the default taste. But you can choose whatever you wished for it to taste like. That is what it tasted like. Why then did the people complain that we remember the fish and the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic? They say all these things we remember that we ate in Egypt. If it could taste like anything you want, just imagine that it tastes like fish, and it tastes like fish. Imagine that it tastes like cucumbers, and it will taste like cucumbers. So you should be able to do the same thing. Imagine that it tastes like something, and just have it taste like whatever you imagine. So the Talmud tells us that it was able to taste like anything except for those things mentioned. Why those things? Because those things are bad for certain people. Some people, those things are not healthy for them. And so, therefore, it couldn't taste like those particular things. Other commentaries say that, yes, it could taste like whatever you want, but still, it was boring. They were eating the same thing each and every day. They were bored of it. It was boring. Even if you can make it taste like whatever you want, it's still the same thing that you're eating. So they were bored of it. They wanted the real thing, not just something tasting like it. So they wanted the real thing, but the manna, according to the Talmud, the Midrashim, had this miraculous property that it actually tasted like whatever you wanted it to taste like.
I have a question.
Sure.
Okay, so I can't quite picture what manna looks like. So when they would wake up in the morning, they would see it covered around.
So let me get to that. Very good question. What exactly did it look like? So the Torah tells us that before the manna fell, there was a layer of dew on the ground. And then the manna fell on top of it, and then dew fell on top of the manna. So commentaries explain that what happened over here is they're in the desert. The desert has very soft sand, like going to the beach, right? Beach sand. The manna would fall on it, it would be full of sand. So first, the ground got wet. When the ground got wet, it's like wet sand that's hard. So whatever falls on it doesn't get sandy. Then there would be this layer of these white balls, white seeds, that would sit on top of the manna. And then the white seeds themselves would be wet, which would keep them clean. So that the liquid on top of the white seed would clean them. And that way, when they would collect it, they would collect these white seeds. And these white seeds would be clean, and they would able to straight away prepare it. So they would go, it would fall around the camp, and the people would go and collect it. Now, the Talmud says that the people had to go to different places to collect it. And the Talmud explains that the righteous people, the manna fell right by their homes. They didn't have homes, they're tents. For average people, they had to go outside the camp and collect it. For wicked people, they had to travel far to find it. Now that would have to be miraculous, because if the manna is right nearby, anyone can pick it up. It would have to be that you could only get the manna designated for you. If you didn't get the manna designated for you, if you tried to get manna that wasn't designated for you, you couldn't pick it up, right? You'd have to go find your manna. But a simple reading of the Torah implies that it fell all around the camp, and they would just go outside with baskets, with bowls, and collect the manna and bring it inside. What did they do once they brought it inside? Now, there would have been a massive amount of manna each and every day. There were 600,000 men over the age of 20. The Talmud says between the ages of 20 and 60. There were, we can presume, an equal number of women. So another 600,000 women. There would have been children. That would be 1.2 million. There would have been children as well. So we can imagine a group of over 1.5 million people, right? Maybe one, even more, right? So a group of over 1.5 million people over here. And maybe even closer to 2 million. And so if there's 1.5 million people, and each person is getting an omer, which is like 3.5 pounds, then over 5 million pounds of manna was falling each and every day. That's an immense, right? 5,000 tons of manna all over the camp. That it was a very large camp, right? So it's the camp itself, the Talmud describes it. It was, you know, there's millions of people. It's a very, very large camp. The Talmud says the camp itself was 12 mil. 12 mil is about, a mil is just over half a mile. So just over 6 miles or 7 miles by 7 miles squared. So almost 50 square miles was the size of the camp of Israel. It was a very large, right? So it's a city, right? 2 million people, 1.5, 2 million people. It's a city. It was a very large place. But a lot of manna fell all over the camp, enough for all the people to get an omer, right? So there were over 5,000 tons of manna coming down each and every day for 40, except for Shabbat, for 40 years. On Friday, there was double that. So they went out, they collected their manna, and they brought it home. The Torah says that then the manna was ground in a mill or in a press, and then it was cooked. Presumably it would be mixed with water, kind of ground into flour, and then mixed with water to make some sort of dough. And then they would cook it, or they could fry it, or bake it, or do whatever, make it in any way they want. So this would appear from the description in the Torah that the manna was kind of a hard seed, a hard grain seed, that you could then crush in a mill or crush in a grinder, and then turn it into some sort of flour, and then use that, mix it with water, make it into a dough, which could then be cooked or baked.
What kind of seed?
It looked like coriander. It was a ball. It was a white ball.
Okay, so
small little balls. Small little balls.
Okay.
It was not a coriander seed. Coriander seeds are brown. Manna is white. But it was... Let me continue this. So I'll get to your question. So Rashi, however, says that there was no need to cook it. There was no need to grind it. You could eat it exactly as it was. Why does the Torah then say it was ground or cooked? It means that you could taste it. You could choose for it to taste any way you want. And you can say, I want it to taste as if it was ground into a and cooked into a, or fried into a pancake or cooked into a bread. You could taste it as if it was ground or cooked. But it actually was something that you would just bite into it as is. You would be able to eat it as is, and they would eat it as is and make it taste any way they wanted. The Talmud says that for the righteous it was ready to eat. For average people they had to cook it. The wicked people had to grind it and make it into a dough and then cook it. But again, from the simple, so there is again different debate over exactly what they did with it, whether it was edible as is or not. From the simple reading of the Torah, it does appear that they ground it, that it was this hard seed, that you could then grind it, like grain, and then turn it into, and then mix it with water, and turn it into a dough, and then cook it or bake it, and then you had some sort of cake or pancake or bread that you would then be able to eat. Tika, what was your question?
Okay, my question was, in the gathering process, I can't imagine like 1.5 million people out there gathering. So did they designate somebody from, like one person from each family?
One person per household gathered for the whole household. However, there were a lot of households. But remember, if it fell all over the camp, they didn't have to go very far. The camp is very, very large. It's 50 square miles, the camp. Right? More than 50 square miles. Right? It's huge. So each person went around their area to collect it, presumably.
So the wicked people, when they went, all of a sudden it disappeared and they had to go far.
That's what it would appear from the Talmud, which is kind of which would make it the very collection itself miraculous. The man itself, of course, is miraculous. It's not surprising. But that's what it would appear from the Talmud's explanation. Again, that's one of a number of different commentaries on how they collected the manna. So it's not, these details are not necessarily clear because we have these conflicting explanations.
Yeah.
Yes, Carol.
Why the distinction between,
the righteous and the wicked?
The righteous and the wicked and the average? I mean,
that's a good question. I think the Talmud is sharing that in general we believe that God pays each person according to their deeds, but it's often not visible. With the manna, it was very visible. that Hashem responded to you according to your deeds. If one day you did something wrong, the next day you didn't find any mana next to your house, you had to go look for it.
Oh, so you could move. It right. was fluid.
It was fluid, yeah. Oh, yeah, people could move between righteous and wicked. It appears so, yes.
What if it was a nice lady married to a wicked man? I'm not trying to be funny.
No, that's a very good question. I don't know. What if it was, what if some members of the household were righteous and some were wicked, which could happen? I don't know. That's a very, very good question. I don't know. Now, since early times, there have been attempts to explain exactly what the mana was to find something that we would recognize that, you know, exists to explain it as the mana, which is part of a general attempt by people throughout history, and when I say throughout history, I mean already for thousands of years, have attempted to explain the various miracles described in the Torah in various practical, natural ways. Whether the plagues, the splitting of the sea, and other miracles described in the Torah, there's been attempts to explain them in natural ways. And so there's been attempts to explain the mana in the same way. Some suggested, this is already going back in early, early times, that it was honeydew. Honeydew is formed on plants when insects eat the sap of the plants, of the flower. So it forms this thing called honeydew. It is soft, it is sweet, tastes. It's from the sap of the plants or from the nectar of the plants. And so some believe that it was honeydew. In fact, there is a honeydew in the Sinai desert that in Arabic today is called mana. In fact, it's called heavenly mana in Arabic. So now it could be that it was called mana after the mana that the Israelites ate, because the Arabs had access to the Torah and knew about the mana, and that is why they called it mana. Rabbi Avraham ben Harambam actually suggests that perhaps the Israelites called it mana because the honeydew in that region was called mana, and it was similar. Not that it was honeydew, it was similar, and they called it after the honeydew. Some suggest that it is the sap of the tamarisk tree, which grows in the Sinai. Others suggest that it's sap from various cactus plants. Some suggest it's some sort of insect, maybe some sort of locust. Regardless, all of these explanations are inadequate. As commentaries have pointed out from the earliest times, and Rabbi Avraham ibn Ezra, one of the classic 12th century commentary on the Torah, discusses these suggestions as well as the suggestions regarding other miracles in the Torah in detail. And he points out, as well as many other, that none of these items that have been identified by various people as mana over the years remotely fit the descriptions of the Torah as a white ball that looked like white coriander seed. None of them fit that description. Sap or honeydew would be soft. If it'd be an insect, it'd look like an insect. None of them fit the description of this white seed. Not only that, they don't fit the Torah's descriptions of it raining down overnight and being spread across the camp in the morning. If it was honeydew, it'd be found on trees. If it was sap, it'd be, or some sort of nectar from trees, it'd be found on the trees. If it was locust, then maybe it could come down, but it wouldn't come down each and every single night. So none of these explanations accurately explain the mana. There's also no way honeydew or sap would have enough nutrients for people to live on over a long period. There's also no way there would be enough of it to feed 1.5 million people over 40 years. So it is clear from the Torah's description that the mana itself was a supernatural event or a supernatural item that does not occur within nature. It looks like a white seed, a white round ball, similar in size and shape to coriander seed, but white. Appears to have been hard so that it could be ground as well. But we have nothing in nature that looks like that. Definitely nothing that appears every single night in such large quantities, repeatedly for 40 years, and then stopped appearing as soon as Israel left the desert. So there is nothing like that within nature. So clearly, it is, as the Torah makes it very clear, a supernatural event orchestrated by Hashem, like many of the events during the Exodus. We have no other way to explain it, and really no reason to explain it. Otherwise, if we take the Torah's account of the manna falling, we can take it that it was a miracle, just like the many other stories in the Torah that were miracles. So they did eat this manna for 40 years. The manna appears to have had the nutrients. They only ate manna, nothing else. So it appears to have had the nutrients to allow them to eat and thrive and grow, including children, grow up for 40 years, whatever nutrients they may have needed. The Talmud even says that the manna there was nothing in the manna that the body could not handle. And so they did not need to relieve themselves, because we relieve ourselves because all the parts of the food that the body does not make use of, releases. We don't need the manna. They did not need to release anything, because everything, it was 100% nutritional. Every single thing worked within their body, and they ate it. Without the need to relieve themselves. The Midrashim actually say that was part of the complaint when they complained about manna. They hadn't gone to the bathroom. Their bowels hadn't worked for a very, very long time. And so they were not happy about that. And that was part of their complaint. But regardless, it was definitely a miracle, a miraculous food that they ate, that came in these very large quantities each and every single night for 40 years. And they ate this food for 40 years. Lewis.
So we know there were about 2 million Jews at the camp. There was also the Arab Rod, the Egyptians who wanted to leave with the Jews. Were they also eating manna?
The mixed multitude, did they eat manna as well? Excellent question. Presumably, yes, they did, because they would not have had anything else to eat. So definitely, the mixed multitude were non-Jews from various nations that joined Israel. They would have eaten the manna as well, along with the Jews, with the Israelites. Absolutely. Yes, Jolie.
Does the Talmud address where the fuel came from to cook, do all this cooking? I spent some time in the desert in the Middle East, and there is ancient wood, but 2 million or 1.5 million people, 60 square miles, sweeping across it for 40 years, even the oldest piece of driftwood would have been collected. I'm just not questioning it. I'm just curious to know.
Where did they get the wood from? So actually, they did have wood for the temple. They carried with them from Egypt. The Talmud does ask that question, where they got it from. That's a very good question. And maybe that is why Rashi and others suggest that it was not actually ground and cooked, but rather it was eaten as is, and they just imagined as if it was ground and cooked, but they did not actually cook it. But maybe that's exactly the reason. You have a very good point. Where would they get that wood from? They could get water if they mixed it with water to create dough. Water they definitely had. We know the water itself in the desert was miraculous. It was produced by a rock that Moses had hit earlier that traveled with them throughout the desert, and they had water in the desert miraculously. But other than manna and water, no, they probably did not have access to wood and fire.
I only raise it because we know about the water from Torah, but it never addresses there's a lot of burning going on. I mean, in the Mishkan as well.
Well, there's the wood in the Mishkan. That would not have been, I mean, they would have burned the Mishkan, would have been fire on the altar for 40 years, but that would not have been all that much wood. They would have been able to secure that amount of wood, in theory.
I'm sorry, one other question. The children, how does the Talmud address how the mothers knew to wean their children and go to the manna? I mean, in my experience with my children, it was not an overnight thing. They went from nursing, some slower than others.
That's a good question. How did they know when to wean their children and go to the manna? And I think what you're asking is, once they started collecting manna from them, if they needed to have an omer per child, they couldn't start off with a little bit and do it slowly. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
I don't know. Good question.
My real question was, did the sages address this issue?
Not that I know of, no. Not that I know of. Very good question. I did not think of it. Yeah. Yes, Tika?
No,
sorry. Yes, Annette?
A lot of cultures use animal dung to cook.
They used animal dung. That's a very good point. Maybe they cooked with animal dung, and they did have animals.
The animals didn't have to release themselves either.
Oh, you're saying if the animals had mana, they didn't have to release. Also a good point. Very good points. Excellent points on both sides.
And with water, people didn't have to release themselves?
Maybe they had to relieve themselves from water, but not from food. So Hashem told Moshe to take a jug and place mana in it and place it before God near the Ark of the Covenant to serve as a permanent reminder of the mana that the people ate. And so indeed, they had this jug of mana that sat next to the Ark of the Covenant in the temple throughout the temple period in the Holy of Holies to remind the people how Hashem had cared for them in the desert. Later, the prophet Jeremiah speaks about how Hashem had cared for them in the desert, and our sages say that he took out the manna and showed the manna to the people and said, look, Hashem can care for you. Look, here is the manna. And indeed, the jug of manna sat in the Holy of Holies next to the Ark of the Covenant throughout Israel's time in the desert, during the time that they had the temple in Shiloh, later the temple in Jerusalem, until eventually the Ark was hidden in the days of King Josiah, the days of King Josiah, alongside one other thing that sat in the Holy of Holies, which was the staff, the stick of Aaron that had performed all those miracles and then later sprouted flowers, and those flowers remained on it, and it sat also in the Holy of Holies next to the Ark of the Covenant. Indeed, we have coins that have been found that were minted by the rebels in the days of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. The Bar Kokhba rebellion was a rebellion in the 130s or 120s, led by a fellow called Shimon Bar Kuziba, who led this rebellion against the Romans, and they were nominally independent for about 2 years until the rebellion was crushed, and during that time they minted coins, and we found many of those coins in various archaeological digs. And the coins on one side have the staff of Aaron with the flowers, and on the other side have the jug with the manna. And so it always remained a symbol of the Jewish people, the jug of manna. It's an eternal symbol of our people. So, yes, Esther. They could have used oil, or maybe they had a very large amount of oil.
They had the sheeps, they could make the wicks.
Possibly. Maybe. I don't know. Good question. So when Israel left Egypt, they experienced many, many miracles in the course of the Exodus. 10 plagues. The splitting of the sea. Their water came from a rock. Their clothing did not wear out over 40 years in the desert. Many, many miracles happened to them throughout the time. Many different miracles they experienced. Yet, Rav Yehuda Halevi writes in his famous book, Kuzari, that the miracle of the manna was, in a sense, the greatest of all the miracles. Because unlike all the other miracles where Hashem manipulated creation, splitting a sea, where the water stood with walls and they could walk down the center, killing the firstborns, turning water into blood, and many other ways that Hashem manipulated in creation, breaking essentially the rules of nature, the rules of physics as we know it. Here, when it came to the manna, He didn't just manipulate creation, He created something new for them, something that didn't exist previously. He created something totally new. But even more so, it wasn't just a one-time miracle, turning water into blood, making frogs appear, killing the firstborn, making a sea split. But here it was a miracle that was continuing for 40 years straight. Each and every day, manna fell. Each day was another miracle. It wasn't just a one-time thing, this one-time miracle. It continued. It was repetitive each and every single day. And furthermore, it wasn't to punish anyone like the plagues. It wasn't to save people in trouble. It was to keep us alive, to sustain us. We lived by God's miracles. we lived, the food that we lived on, that we were sustained on, was a miraculous thing. Later in the Torah, the Torah said, Moshe tells the people that the purpose of the manna was to teach us to rely on Hashem. When Hashem first gave us the manna, he told Moshe that it's going to be to test us, to see if we listen to him. In what way is it testing us? It's testing us to see if we can rely on him. Every day we collected enough manna for that day. They had to collect exactly an omer of manna, no more, no less, and they had to eat the entire thing that day. They couldn't collect any manna and leave it for tomorrow. Every day when they went to sleep, their pantry was bare. They had no pantries. There was nothing saved for the next day. You wake up in the morning, you're relying the manna is going to fall tomorrow, because if it doesn't fall tomorrow, you have nothing to eat. Every day they were relying on the manna. And it was in order to remind the people that every single day they have to rely on Hashem. Every day you're going to rely on him, then he's going to give you food the next day. And this is a lesson for us to know, that we don't live by the work of our hands, but we live by the help of Hashem. We think that it is our work that gives us what we need, but it is not. We think it is the bank account that we have, that we will be able to withdraw money from and be able to pay for our needs, but it is not. We think it is the food sitting in our pantry that we will eat tomorrow, but it is not. It is relying on Hashem. It is Hashem who gives us the food. Hashem gives us everything that we have. Even when the food is sitting in front of us, it is only Hashem who gives it to us. In a moment, you can lose everything. The money in your bank account takes a moment for it to disappear. People who had their money in certain banks, Silicon Valley, discovered that very quickly, right? All it takes is a moment for all that money to disappear. Your food in your pantry takes a moment. Everything can disappear in a moment. There is no guarantees. Ultimately, even though today we can leave for tomorrow and plan for the future, ultimately, you have to rely on Hashem. The manna teaches us that everything that we have is not really our own. It's not really our own doing. We feel like it's our own, but it's not really our own. We are relying on Hashem. And that is why if we don't, we always need to trust in Him that Hashem will provide. So if we have, remember, whatever you have is only Hashem giving it to you. And in a moment, He could take it away from you. All it takes is a moment. You could lose it all in a moment. It also teaches us that if you don't have, don't despair. Hashem can provide it for you within a moment. Sometimes when you think about it, people struggle. I often get called by people when they lose their jobs. When they have jobs, they don't bother calling me. People lose their jobs for some reason. They think I can help them. They call the rabbi. Well, they want guidance and advice and support. But miracles. So people call the rabbi. But when you think about it, there are 8 billion people, or almost 8 billion people on earth. And almost all of them are employed and have a job. How many different jobs there are out there? And there seems to be a job for everyone. And everybody who is here, whether you have everything you need or you don't have everything you need, whether you have a job or you don't have a job, whether you know where your food is coming from tomorrow or you don't, the very fact that you're here today means that God has somehow sustained you, whether with ease or with difficulty, to get here today, to be here today, that you're still alive. You've somehow still been alive, still being given whatever you need to stay alive until today. Everything may have been difficult, but you've been given what you need until today. And He sustains 8 billion people, each one with their own niche. Ultimately, everybody gets what Hashem has in mind for them. Now, that doesn't mean that you could just sit back and say, Hashem, you take care of me. I'm just going to go to sleep and you do everything for me. Because He doesn't work that way. If you don't step up and make an effort on your own, He won't give you anything. He wants you to work hard. He wants you to find a way to make money and to take care of yourself. But you're just giving him a means to give you blessings. Well, the way our sages said, you're giving Hashem a vessel within which to place the blessings, a bowl within which to put the blessings in. It is not that your work makes money. Evidence for the fact that some people work hard and make money, and some people work hard and don't make money. It's not that the people who are making money are working harder, necessarily, or that the people who are making money are smarter, because in fact, many people make money for part of their lives and do very well, and for part of their lives don't do very well. Did they become less smart? Did they start working less? It's all up to Hashem. Hashem ultimately gives it to us. So we need to do our part. But we need to learn from the mana that we rely on Hashem each and every day for everything that we have. And that is why Hashem told Moshe to save the mana in a jar. So you always remember that for everything that we have, we are relying on Hashem. It is up to Hashem, it is up to Hashem to give us each and every single day. Don't think it's coming from you. You're just making the vessel. You're giving him the means to sustain you. But ultimately what you're getting is coming from Hashem. And that is why our sages say that a person should read the Torah story of the manna every day. And in many prayer books, it is actually printed. The reading of the manna from the book of Exodus is printed in the many prayer books, not in the blue ones that we have here, but in many prayer books it is printed for people to read it each and every day to remind themselves that everything that we have ultimately comes from Hashem. And really, you have to rely on Hashem, trust in Hashem that He will take care of you.